the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network presents Vatican Insider with Joan Lewis. Each week, Joan brings you news from inside the Vatican and the Church around the world, as well as interviews and answers to your questions. Now, here's the host of Vatican Insider, Joan Lewis.
Welcome to Vatican Insider. I just wanted to tell you I'll be away for a bit on vacation, but my terrific colleagues and friends at EWTN Radio will be preparing a Best Of series in my absence. So sit back this weekend and enjoy a special listening adventure. This week, we visit St. Sebastian, the last of what are called the seven pilgrim basilicas of Rome. The four papal basilicas of St. Peter's, St. John Lateran, St. Mary Major, and St. Paul's Outside the Walls, Holy Cross in Jerusalem, and St. Lawrence al Verano. St. Sebastian was built above the catacombs of the same name and is dedicated to the 3rd century saint who was twice martyred. The first mention of St. Sebastian dates back to a 4th century entry in the Roman church calendar that refers to the saint's January 20th feast day. St. Ambrose, Bishop of Milan at the end of that same century, in a letter to the Milanese faithful marking that day, wrote, quote, "The example of St. Sebastian, whose feast is today, should help us. He was a native of Milan." Little is known of the saint, although a tale called The Passion of St. Sebastian, dating to the time of Pope Sixtus III, who reigned 432 to 440, recounts that he was a member of the elite first Praetorian cohort of the Emperor Maximinianus, who denounced him for his preaching of the gospel and condemned him to be shot to death by archers. Sebastian was found still alive by Irene, the widow of St. Castulus, who nursed him back to health. Once recovered, he returns to the emperor, who orders him taken to the Palatine Circus and beaten to death. The tale continues. Sebastian appears in a dream to a lady named Lucina, tells her that his body can be found in the sewers where it was thrown after his beating, and asks her to bring it to the catacombs and bury it near the remains of the apostles Peter and Paul. St. Sebastian today is always depicted with arrows piercing his body, however. He is the patron of athletes and archers. Pope John Paul, a lover of sports and great sportsman himself for many years, is buried in the chapel of St. Sebastian next to the Pietà in St. Peter's Basilica. St. Sebastian's body remained in his tomb in the catacombs until 826, when Pope Eugene II had it removed to the Vatican to a special altar in the oratory of St. Gregory the Great. The head and other relics were later given to the Church of the Quattro Coronati, the four crowned saints. Pope Honorius III, who reigned 1216 to 1227, answering petitions by the faithful, as well as by the Cistercian monks officiating at the basilica, ordered the relics returned to the catacombs and deposited in an ancient cosmatesque altar in the crypt, an altar he personally reconsecrated. When Cardinal Scipione Borghese restored the church in the 17th century, he transferred this altar to the basilica itself, placing it against the left wall, and we'll see this shortly. The Basilica of St. Sebastian and the catacombs beneath it are inseparable in their history, which comprises four distinct periods. The first is mainly pagan, and dates from the first to the middle of the 3rd century. The second era, both pagan and Christian, dates from about 250 AD to 330 AD. The third period, Christian, lasts from the building of the church in the first half of the 4th century to the Middle Ages. The final period dates from the end of the 16th century to the present. The first basilica, much larger than the present one, was originally called the Basilica of the Apostles. It had a nave and two aisles and a colonnaded ambulatory, later narrowed down to the present single nave. We know that very often basilicas were built underground, in the catacombs themselves, in commemoration of a particular saint or saints. Later, to accommodate increased numbers of pilgrims coming to visit the tombs or relics of these saints, larger basilicas were built above ground over the saint's tomb. St. Sebastian's Basilica was termed, and still is today, In Memoriam Apostolorum, in the memory of the apostles, because for a period, the faithful had gathered in these catacombs to venerate the remains of the two apostles Peter and Paul. There are various theories as to why pilgrims came here. Some scholars believe the apostles lived here for a time. Others say their remains were brought here to make it possible to jointly commemorate the two great apostles. and yet others believe their relics were brought to these catacombs for safekeeping. Remember, we're not yet in the time of Emperor Constantine, the first Christian emperor and the first to allow Christians to openly and freely profess their faith. In any case, as we shall see shortly, remarkable evidence exists that the relics of Peter and Paul were indeed brought here and jointly venerated around the year 250 AD. Within this underground cemetery on the Via Appia Antica, a small portico had been raised, overlooking a courtyard at a lower level from which steps descended, leading to a well. On the rear wall of the portico, there was a mason bench. The whole structure, found in other catacombs as well, was called the triclia, that is, a place near a sepulchre where funerary banquets, often called refrigerarium, meaning refreshments, took place, and where the faithful gathered to commemorate the deceased. In this particular case, what made it so special was that above the bench on the wall of the portico, still visible today behind a protective plexiglass wall, were over 600 graffiti inscribed to the memory of the Apostles Peter and Paul. The Liber Pontificalis, or Book of the Popes, which contained biographies of early pontiffs, recounts that Pope Damasus, who reigned 366 to 384, who had a passion for writing verses to memorialize saints and martyrs, had the following inscribed on a slab adorning the site where the bodies of the apostles rested. Quote, "Here you should know that the saints once dwelt, you who are seeking the names of both Peter and Paul. The Orient sent us these apostles, we admit it willingly. But through their martyrdom, following Christ above in the celestial spheres and in the kingdom of the righteous, Rome was enabled to claim them as her citizens. This is, O new stars, what Damasus wanted to say in your praise." The old basilica, about 2,400 square yards in size, was erected above this Memoriam Apostolorum and covered the entire area now occupied by the museum, the choir, the two sacristies, and the Albani Chapel. Built around 340 AD during the reign of Pope Julius, it followed a typical Constantinian basilica form of a nave, two aisles circling the apse to join together. It is generally believed that this basilica was not dedicated to Saint Sebastian until the Middle Ages, although there are records indicating that Pope Saint Gregory the Great, who ruled 590 to 604, delivered a homily here on the feast of Saint Sebastian, thus suggesting to some the church was already dedicated to this saint. Modifications and changes to the facade and inside of the basilica were made over the centuries, and what we see today mostly dates from the early 17th century. A small walled courtyard just off the Via Appia Antica welcomes us to the basilica, whose two-tiered facade was commissioned by Cardinal Scipione Borghese and designed by Flaminio Ponzio. The upper tier has three large windows and the Borghese coat of arms. The lower tier, leading to the atrium and the basilica entrance, consists of three arcades resting on six Ionic columns, four in red granite and two in gray Egyptian granite. An inscription marks this as the work of Cardinal Borghese and dates it to 1612. The central door leads to the church, whereas the door on your right leads to the ticket office and entrance of the catacombs, a spacious waiting area whose walls are decorated by fragments of stone and marbles that were once part of tombs or mausoleums in the catacombs. The catacombs themselves are, on the average, 55 feet below the actual basilica. Entering the basilica, we're struck by its luminosity. As it has only a single nave, we're able to observe the church's features, the ceiling, floor, and side chapels, unfettered by columns or other distractions. First off, we note the elaborate wood-coffered ceiling, at whose center is the figure of Saint Sebastian. Cardinal Borghese's coat of arms also appears. On our left, near the entrance, is the only inscription by Pope Damasus to have survived to the present, unbroken and intact. Dedicated to Saint Eutychius, it was first placed in the crypt of Saint Sebastian, but was transferred to the basilica in the 16th century. It describes in minute detail the sufferings of this martyr, whose body was eventually moved from the church of San Lorenzo in Damaso. On this same wall is the ornate marble chapel and altar of Saint Sebastian. We saw that Cardinal Borghese in 1612 had brought Saint Sebastian's altar from the catacombs to the basilica. Around 1672, Cardinal Francesco Barberini commissioned the chapel we see today, small yet suggestive, and lovely with its polychrome marble. Behind a huge metal grate, we see the altar table where an urn containing the remains of the saint had been placed. Beneath the altar is a marble statue of Saint Sebastian, commissioned by Cardinal Barberini as he imagined the saint to be at his martyrdom, and that is, with arrows piercing his body, which is partially wrapped in a shroud. Just across the way is the altar of the relics, housed in a chapel whose decoration was ordered by Maximilian, Duke of Bavaria, in 1625. Above the altar, encased in glass, are reliquaries containing one of the arrows that pierced Saint Sebastian on your left, and the column to which he was tied when the archers shot him. That's on your right. Proceeding up the right side of the church to the right of the high altar, we come to the only other chapel, the Albani Chapel, the largest and most richly decorated of the three in the basilica. It is dedicated to Saint Fabian, who was co-patron of this church with Saint Sebastian, and whose remains are believed to rest in a sarcophagus under the floor in the center of the chapel. Pope Clement XI, who ruled from 1706 to 1712, a member of the Albani family, had this chapel erected as a burial chapel for the members of his family. Designed by Carlo Fontana, its beauty comes from its magnificent bronze and wrought iron railings, statues, stuccos, and precious marbles. A statue of St. Fabian, represented as a 17th-century pope, dominates the altar. We return to the apse in the main altar, reconstructed by Cardinal Barberini with material from the catacombs and the previous altar. The altar is covered by a canopy resting on four columns of green marble. The apse ceiling was restored by Pope Gregory XVI, who reigned from 1831 to 1846. After visiting the basilica, you will, of course, want to visit the catacombs, the cubicle of St. Philip Neri, the arcosolium in Gallery 3 featuring traces of a painting of the crib, the cubicle of Jonah discovered in 1950 with its four frescoes depicting the biblical episode of Jonah and the whale, and the astonishing Roman villa built around a large square courtyard with a reception room paved in black and white marble and whose walls are decorated with architectural designs and pictures. There's a kind of a fork in the road in Gallery 9. One path will take you to the Roman villa, and the second will take you to the Pizzuola, or little square, 9 meters under the floor of the basilica to the south of its foundations. Here we see the facades of what look like three small homes, but which are stately mausoleums. Entirely hewn into the rock and rising to a great height, the facades are of masonry and brickwork and date to the first half of the 2nd century. The entryways are of travertine. Above the doors are rectangular spaces that were intended for the tituli, the marble plates on which were inscribed the name of the family whose members are entombed. Each entrance is crowned by a tympanum, a triangular recessed space. Low walls rising above the tympanum formed a sort of terrace area called a solaria, which served as a meeting place at the time of the burial when the small banquets, the famous refrigeria, took place. The last mausoleum, the one to our far left, standing against the basilica's foundations, has been given the name Mausoleum of the Axe because of the two-bladed axe depicted in a stucco relief in the tympanum. The most astonishing element of these mausoleums is their decorations, the vibrant ornamental frescoes considered to be Christian, the elaborate mosaic floors, the lunettes, stuccos, and bas-reliefs. It staggers the imagination to think that almost 18 centuries have passed.
This is Jim Pinto, Director of EWTN Media Missionaries. EWTN's mission is to spread the eternal word and to teach others that Jesus Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. You can help EWTN share the good news by becoming a media missionary. Visit EWTNmissionaries.com today and join us in sharing the eternal word with the world.
This is a Messy Family Minute with Mike and Alicia Hernan. We love the rosary. But when you have a group of rambunctious children, the thought of praying a family rosary can be kind of daunting.
Maybe it's because your ideal way of praying a family rosary doesn't match reality. Or maybe you've always found it just tough to pray the rosary. But it is a most powerful prayer. Our Lady gave it to us to encourage, protect, and sustain us.
You may feel like your family is bad at praying the rosary, but the good news is that there's lots of ways to use this powerful weapon of prayer. Prepare the environment. Get rid of phones, put away distracting toys, light candles, wait till everyone's calm, maybe even on the way to bed.
Or take it outside. If your kids are too energetic, do a walking rosary. And don't forget car trips when the kids are locked in your vehicle. And a rosary on the way to Mass is a great preparation. For more on this topic, listen to our podcast on family prayer at messyfamilyminute.org.
Welcome back to Vatican Insider. Here's Joan Lewis.
Welcome back to Vatican Insider and to another special I've prepared on a much-loved, very celebrated Italian shrine, Our Lady of the Rosary of Pompeii, a half hour south of Naples, which has a beautiful and even touching story. It's a shrine that has a special place in my heart. Now I'm going to start the story of the shrine with a quote from the man who founded Our Lady of the Rosary of Pompeii. Quote, "With the boldness of desperation, I lifted my face and hands to the Heavenly Virgin and cried, 'If it be true that you promised St. Dominic that whoever spreads the rosary will be saved, I will be saved, because I will not leave Pompeii until I have spread your rosary.'" Those are the words of Blessed Bartolo Longo, said in Pompeii, Italy, in October 1872. Now, let's go back a bit in time for the story of Blessed Bartolo and the shrine of Our Lady of the Rosary of Pompeii. At 1 p.m. on August 24th, 79 B.C., Mount Vesuvius rumbled, roared, and then erupted, heaving its molten insides onto the populace of Pompeii and burying the ancient city. What remained was only a ghostly silence of a once flourishing center. The new Pompeii would arise 1796 years later. Called the Miracle City by its inhabitants, Pompeii as we know it today is the result of that promise made by Bartolo Longo, a lawyer and devout layman, a promise that became a reality in 1875 when work began on the construction of the church dedicated to Our Lady of the Rosary. The church and the buildings housing the charitable works associated with it eventually led to the birth of the city, the new Pompeii. Bartolo Longo was born in 1841 near Brindisi on Italy's Adriatic coast. Those who knew him as a young man described him as cordial, easygoing, of a lively intelligence, and devoted to the church. However, his university years were to be troubled ones, as anti-clerical sentiments were running strong in newly unified Italy. Prodded by anti-church liberals, Bartolo tested the waters, if you will, of Spiritism, and he went through a crisis in his faith. Aided by two good friends, Professor Vincenzo Pepe and the learned Dominican Father Alberto Radente, he not only rediscovered his faith, but renounced his legal career and devoted himself to works of charity and religious studies. Providence brought Bartolo Longo to the little town of Pompeii, a half hour south of Naples, in 1872, where a widow and the mother of five, the Countess Mariana de Fusco, asked him to administer her property. Struck by the human and religious poverty of the peasants of the area, Bartolo anguished over how he could help them better their lives. Following a divine inspiration, he decided to devote himself to teaching the catechism and spreading devotion to the rosary, remembering Father Radente's words, "If you are looking for salvation, propagate the rosary. It is the promise of Mary. He who propagates the rosary shall be saved." For 3 years, Bartolo Longo organized yearly festivals in the fall to bring the people together for catechesis and to pray the rosary. This could be best achieved, he felt, if the people had a proper church with an image of Our Lady of the Rosary as the focal point. Thus, in 1875, he began searching the stores of Naples, hoping to have one in time for that year's concluding ceremonies on November 13th. The ever-faithful and supportive Father Rodente recalled that years earlier he had bought such an image, which he had entrusted to Sister Maria Concetta of the Conservatory of the Rosary at Porta Medina. Bartolo hurried to Porta Medina, asked for the painting, and was horrified when he saw how ugly it was and how much in need of repair. He would later write, "Dear me, I felt a tightening around my heart as soon as I set eyes on it." When Countess de Fusco saw the painting of the Virgin with the child Jesus handing rosaries to St. Dominic and St. Rose of Lima, she said, "It seems to have been made specifically to discourage devotion." To make matters worse, the size of the painting precluded Bartolo taking it to Pompeii on the train. The only other possible form of transportation was through a wagoneer who weekly transported a load of manure to Pompeii. So the wagon it was to be. The painting was touched up for the November 13th ceremony and has since been restored 3 times, during which St. Rose was changed to St. Catherine of Siena. Today, the painting hangs above the main altar of the Basilica, beckoning to several million pilgrims annually as strongly as it once repulsed Bartolo Longo and his loyal supporters. By 1855, some 940 cures and miracles were ascribed to Our Lady of the Rosary of Pompeii. The number well exceeds that today, as witnessed by the countless ex-votos lining the walls of the shrine and adjacent buildings. On my first visit, as I lingered to study several hundred of the votive offerings, the ex-voto, a catechesis to Mary's intercession, I realized that here was the true history of the shrine. A single man's love for the rosary, transmitted to generations of faithful. He loved, they believed, and together they built what is today one of the preeminent Marian shrines in the world. Each year on May 8th and on the first Sunday of October, thousands of faithful gather at the shrine for the Feast of the Supplication, to petition favors, and to offer thanksgiving for favors received. In fact, most if not all of the plaques of thanksgiving that line the walls and halls and corridors of this shrine have the letters PGR on them, Per Grazie Ricevute, for favors received, and this is what I referred to earlier as ex votos. The neoclassical pontifical shrine and basilica of Our Lady of the Rosary, in all of its frescoed marble splendor, was dedicated in 1891. 15 years after Bartolo began to collect pennies from the peasants to build this citadel to Mary. But our devoted lawyer felt that this monument would be incomplete if works of charity were not part of it, and so, over the years, until his death in 1926, Bartolo founded homes for orphan girls, for the sons of prisoners, and later orphaned boys. Today, this monumental complex, the pulsating heart of the new Pompeii, includes administrative offices, a chapel for confessions, a school, a home for elderly women, and the offices of the monthly publication, The Rosary and the New Pompeii. It began in 1884. It also houses the living quarters and offices of the prelate of Pompeii and the shrine director. On my first visit to the shrine a number of years ago, I had a long conversation with the then director, Monsignor Pietro Gaggiano, who was also my guide to the shrine. It was a Sunday morning, and after Mass, we began our tour. At the end of our visit, Monsignor Gaggiano left his office for a minute, and when he came back, he asked me if I had lunch plans. I said I had nothing special planned, probably just someplace near the shrine, and he said that Archbishop Francesco Toppi, the prelate of the shrine and territorial prelature, wanted to invite me for lunch. It was a great lunch with marvelous conversation. If I had 100 questions about the shrine, Archbishop Toppi had 200 questions about the Pope, the Vatican, the press office, and any interesting tidbits I could give him. After lunch, I had a really special treat when Monsignor and the Archbishop took me to one of the rooms that Pope John Paul had been to during his 1979 visit. Archbishop Toppi walked to an immense piece of furniture, opened at the top drawer, and took out a very large book, the Shrine's VIP guest book. He proudly opened it to John Paul's signature, and then he showed me a few more famous names, and then opened to a blank page and asked me to sign the book. I said, in no way did I feel worthy to be part of such an important volume. And he said, but we are all children of God. So my signature has now been immortalized in Pompeii. The devotion of this wonderful Capuchin Archbishop and Monsignor Gaggiano to the shrine in Bartolo Longo was palpable as they spoke reverently of his exemplary life and emphasized the fact it was a layperson who accomplished the, quote, miracle of Pompeii, who founded the still flourishing works of charity, and who in 1897 founded the Dominican Sisters of the Holy Rosary of Pompeii. Both of them also pointed with pride to Pope John Paul's 1979 visit to the shrine and to the tomb of the man he would beatify the following year. In fact, Blessed Bartolo Longo is buried beneath the image he had wished. We spoke of miracles and of saints. I asked if it was harder today in a fast-paced secular world with temptations on every corner to become a saint. Archbishop Topi answered, "Every time has its trials and its temptations, and every time has its saints. We are conditioned by the times in which we live, and we adjust to meet those times and face up to those trials." Now a little postscriptum. On April 2, 2014, exactly 7 years to the day of his death, the cause for canonization for Archbishop Topi was opened. The current prelate of the Shrine of Our Lady of the Rosary of Pompeii, as I said earlier, Archbishop Tommaso Caputo, having asked the opinion of the other bishops of the Campania region, and having obtained the nulla osta, nothing's in the way, of the Congregation for the Causes of Saints, decreed the introduction of the cause. The request was put forth by Father Carlo Coloni, OFM Cap, Postulator General of the Cause of Beatification of Archbishop Topi. And another postscriptum. In April 2014, Monsignor Gaggiano, former administrator of the shrine, was named rector of the local seminary. Thanks for tuning in to the Best of Vatican Insider while I'm on vacation. And thanks to my EWTN colleagues and their hard work in preparing this week's program. Come back next weekend for another special listening adventure.
For more information on these stories, or to check out Joan's blog and to ask her a question, go to EWTN.com. That's EWTN.com. Thanks for listening to Vatican Insider on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.